Azam's thinking about jihad, born of his hatred for Israel, had a powerful impact on his radically minded co-religionists. Against the widespread belief that jihad was a collective duty of the community and that only a legitimate political authority could lead such a fight, Azam argued that the Muslim world faced a defensive jihad. Muslim lands were threatened, and every Muslim man must join the fight, an obligation that had priority over everything else, including family and job. With Soviets overrunning Afghanistan, Azam's arguments resonated loudly. Azam became a mentor for bin Laden. The Saudis' belief in the re-establishment of a caliphate through an immediate jihad and his disdain for secular Arab nationalism were undoubtedly fostered by this relationship. Bin Laden's money, which he distributed liberally for the jihadist cause, endeared him to Azam. Around 1984, the two joined forces. Together, they established the Maktab al-Khidmat, the services bureau, which would set up a recruiting network for fighters, bring them to Peshawar, put them up in the organization's guest houses, and dispatch them to training camps. Azam ran the organization. Bin Laden funded it. One of the first offices opened was out of a storefront on Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn, New York, and Azam sent one of his protégés, Mustafa Shalabi, to run it. Through the latter half of the 1980s, bin Laden shuttled between Saudi Arabia and Pakistan. At home, he spoke publicly about the stirring events in Afghanistan and recruited others to join the fight. Much like Ibn Taymiyyah, who roused the Mamluk warriors from behind the lines to fight the Mongols at Mardin in 1303, bin Laden was more cheerleader than battle-hardened mujahid during the Afghan jihad. By the late 1990s, when they had been in the field for years, the Arab Afghans, as the foreign fighters were known, were some of the toughest units fighting for the Taliban. In the 1980s, though, they were relatively few in number, unseasoned, and often unserious. To many, participating in the jihad was something akin to a stint in Outward Bound. Some stayed in the field for only a matter of weeks. Among Western governments, there was a snickering at the time about jihad jollies, the practice of Gulf Arabs traveling to the region to discharge their obligation to fight in the Holy War. The visitors would pay large sums to live in air-conditioned cargo containers that had been turned into motel rooms. When they left the comfort of their lodgings, anti-aircraft guns, rocket-propelled grenade launchers, and assault rifles were waiting for them outside, which they would fire even though no enemy was anywhere nearby. Those who actually made it to the front usually fought in support of the most Islamically radical Afghan commanders, Abdul Rasul Sayaf and Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, men who were both vicious and ineffective leaders. The Arab Afghans were considered more of a hindrance than help. One battle, late in the conflict, was an exception. In fighting at Ali Kel in Paktia province, Arab Afghans stopped Soviet forces from advancing in fierce battle. Bin Laden took part, and while the details of his actions are clouded by myth, his reputation as a fighter was made there. Towering over most Arabs at about 6'6", bin Laden is a commanding figure. That he was known to be a member of a fabulously wealthy family and faced great danger when he could have been living the good life gave this new legend luster. This Galahad-like persona, the ascetic warrior prince holding God's banner aloft, would become the core of the bin Laden myth. The last of the Soviet troops crossed the Friendship Bridge over the Amu Darya and out of Afghanistan in mid-February 1989. The toll over 9 years of fighting was 15,000 Soviet troops dead or missing in Afghanistan. That was less than a third of U.S. losses in Vietnam. But the number of Soviet soldiers who were sick or wounded was 30 times the number of dead, a staggering figure. And the social, economic, and political costs of defeat were so humiliating that they proved to be an important factor in the undoing of the Soviet Union. The effect of victory on the Islamists was electrifying. They believed that all due credit was theirs and Allah's. Repeatedly in interviews, bin Laden has scoffed at the notion that America's multi-billion dollar contribution in money and material, such as the vaunted Stinger missile, made any difference to the outcome of the war, boasting that those who participated in the jihad in Afghanistan bear the greatest responsibility in this regard, because they realize that with insignificant capabilities, with a small number of RPGs, with a small number of anti-tank mines, with a small number of Kalashnikov rifles, they managed to crush the greatest empire known to mankind. After 40 years in which believers had seen the Muslim armies of impious nationalist rulers defeated four times by Israel in the Middle East, and four times in South Asia in the Indo-Pakistan conflict, the triumph was a transcendent event. Amid this intoxication, bin Laden began thinking about carrying the struggle forward. In 1989, with those closest to him in Pakistan and Afghanistan, he began organizing the group that would become Al-Qaeda. One of the men in this circle was Ayman al-Zawahiri, the leader of a faction of the Egyptian Islamic Jihad, or EIJ. A doctor by profession and 6 years older than bin Laden, al-Zawahiri was a link to the original al-Jihad, the predecessor of EIJ, which he joined in his teens. After the assassination of Sadat, al-Zawahiri was convicted on a weapons charge and spent 3 years in prison. Another eminence who appeared in Peshawar from time to time was Sheikh Omar Abdul Rahman. How much direct contact the blind Sheikh had with bin Laden is not clear. But Rahman's ideas were in the air, and two of his sons would eventually join al-Qaeda. Bin Laden would later claim that he already knew during the fighting against the Russians that his ultimate enemy would be the United States. Yet as they were first articulated, the goals of al-Qaeda, or the Islamic Army as it was also called at the time, resembled those of the Egyptian jihadists. The organization would be dedicated to the goal of toppling existing Muslim governments and establishing a new caliphate, an undivided Islamic realm ruled by Sharia. The means for accomplishing these aims would be jihad.